talking to me?
Funny, like I'm a clown, I amuse you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Welcome to We Are Movie Geeks. Today is Monday, September 14th. I am Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
Lynn Venhouse.
Lynn Venhouse is here. That is so exciting. Michelle is currently in Boise, the vacation capital of Idaho. I believe she's there for a wedding, actually. Lynn is sitting in for Michelle. Lynn reviews movies for the Belleville News Democrat. And you also review theater.
Yes.
How long have you been reviewing movies and theater for the Belleville News Democrat?
I've been doing movies since 1987, off and on. And I've been doing theater since 2008 at the News Democrat. But I've been doing it a lot longer.
I see. So do you see a lot of plays? Do you see more plays or more movies?
I see more movies.
I see.
Because movies are like average two a week.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes plays are two a week, too. So it just depends. But the St. Louis, what's really great is the St. Louis theater scene is the art scene is really thriving. And, of course, the film scene, because you guys know, is quite a hotbed of conversation these days.
Sure.
Yeah, we've got a lot of, I guess you would call them art theaters here in town. It's surprising.
Do.
Yeah, like maybe a dozen or so, or close to.
A dozen screens, you're probably right. Yeah. What do you prefer reviewing movies or plays?
I like both because it's a different art form. But if you like art, if you like good stories, because to me it all boils down to story. If you got a good story, whether it's cinema or the stage, it grabs you in, sucks you in, takes you to a new place, lets you see things in a different way.
But aren't plays just kind of boring compared to movies?
They don't have flying chunks of concrete.
You can never see Mad Max Fury Road on stage. Although they should make that into a musical.
Well, we don't have enough singing cats in the movies, though. Yeah.
Well, I just saw a play actually called Mr. Burns, a post-electric play. And it takes a Simpsons episode, the Cape Fear episode.
One of my favorites.
This group has survived what you assume is some sort of apocalypse.
Yeah.
And for fun, they're sitting around the campfire and they're talking about the episode of Cape Fear with Bart and Sideshow Bob.
Yeah.
And they go through the whole routine. And then the second act morphs into now they're a stage company. 7 years later, they're a stage company. Right. And they reenact the Cape Fear.
Oh, that's hilarious. Oh,
I know. So, you know, you never know what you're going to expect.
No.
There is some really fantastic talent in this town.
Yeah. Have you heard about this play about LBJ?
Oh, it's one of the best things I've ever seen.
Oh, my wife won tickets to see it. But
you are going to love it.
Well, she's not taking me.
Oh.
So I won't love it.
Okay. And then
I'm seeing Everest that night. So.
Okay. Well, the Full Monty is at Stages, and that is based on the movie. But they've set it in Buffalo, New York. So it's out of work steelworkers in Buffalo. But it is so joyous and fun. So I highly recommend if you want to just fun, entertaining evening, go to Full Monty. If you want to look at our history of our country, go to the LBJ all the way.
Okay. Well, those are the plays that Lynn recommends. But we did not invite Lynn on here to talk about theater. We invited Lynn to come on here and talk about movies. But really, Lynn, what are some of your favorite movies of all time?
Okay. Well, you know the quote that Steve Martin says in Grand Canyon, all of life's riddles are answered in the movies. All of life's riddles are answered in the movies. But anyway, I go back because I'm old, but I go back to watching movies with my mom on Saturday night, black and white movies, and she tended more towards the tearjerker MGM musicals. Hey, kids, let's put on a show. So I grew up like that. But I also grew up with my grandfather who loved gangster movies. So I had a deep appreciation for Humphrey Bogart and James Cagney and all that in the 60s. And then I went to college in the 70s, and you know the golden age of cinema.
Mm-hmm.
So my eyes, this is pre-VCRs and DVDs. And if we would have had DVDs when
VHS,
I was in college, I don't think I would have graduated in 4 years.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. But you got your world expanded through, social commentary. I like movies that say something. And you know in the 60s and 70s, movies said something.
Mm-hmm.
But also, look at the fun. Going to see Jaws and Star Wars and Halloween on opening nights and just having your world expanded that way. And,
let's get specific, though, Lynn.
Okay. Yeah, we got some titles finally there.
Okay.
So,
okay. Yeah. Well, okay. My favorite movies are Casablanca,
mm-hmm.
and Gone with the Wind, because mm-hmm. it has a very sentimental meaning for me. It's a long story, so I won't tell you. And then I love Citizen Kane just for the artistry and the way Orson Welles expanded what could be done on cinema. But I love On the Waterfront mm-hmm. and The Godfather 1 and 2. The Godfather Part 2 is just, if you watch it again, it's just truly stunning.
I just saw it at the theater again. They showed it at AMC on a Sunday afternoon about a year ago.
Oh. The second Godfather, yeah. huh?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it. Number one, they play occasionally. In fact, did you see it at the Symphony, Part 1?
No, I did not.
It was amazing. Have you ever seen them do that? They played the score. They separated the soundtrack out of the film, and then they played the score with the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra, and I saw it, and it was pretty amazing. I mean, you couldn't really, if you closed your eyes, you couldn't tell the difference.
Wow. Yeah. And then Annie Hall, I know every word. I still quote it. I still love Woody for his talent mm-hmm. and his writing. Fargo, the Coen brothers.
Sure.
So I like the quirky offbeat. I love the early independent movies, because they just were different, you know? They just took the studio, because I am not the biggest fan of the special effect extravaganzas that have the nonstop explosions. You know, the Second City people used to say, load up real good. Mm-hmm. Give me a story. That's what I want. I want a story. I want, like, Love and Mercy is on DVD right now, right? Yeah. Rental on
starting
demand.
Starting tomorrow, yeah.
And Paul Dano as mm-hmm. Brian Wilson. Truly amazing. If you have good storytelling, compelling acting, people who go there, who, you know, I like the classic guys, like, you know.
Yeah, that's my next question. Who are some of your favorite actors and actresses of all time?
Okay, well, Paul Newman, Robert Redford, Tom Hanks, George Clooney, to name the current ones. And I love, like, the current, you know, hot people like Mark Ruffalo, Edward Norton.
What about Ryan Gosling? Oh, he's dreamy.
Oh, yes. Ryan Gosling is dreamy, and he is. When you see Half Nelson, you see a side of him that you've never seen before. I love when people show you a new side of them, when they show you what they can do. And, of course, the grand dames, Meryl Streep and Helen Mirren and Emma Thompson. Mm-hmm. But then Jennifer Lawrence, she is mesmerizing on screen. You can't take your eyes off her when she's in a movie.
Yeah. Who are some of your favorite directors of all time?
I would say Hitchcock, mm-hmm. North by Northwest. Oh, who doesn't love a good Cary Grant movie, right? And so North by Northwest. But remember the first time you saw Psycho?
Sure.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God. You never forget that. And The Birds?
Yeah.
Terrifying. And just even the smaller films that he did in the 40s, like Shadow of a Doubt.
Mm-hmm. Strangers on a Train.
Oh, Strangers on a Train. Look how many copycats that movie has inspired. So, who else? I got to go with Spielberg and I love Christopher Nolan. I know a lot of people, there's a backlash, but those Dark Knight movies, the Batman movies, are, to me, they're epic.
What about Russ Meyer?
I did see Beyond the Valley of the Dolls because... Yeah. Roger Ebert wrote it.
Yeah, I know. He also wrote Up, which was a Russ Meyer. You know, they're making a movie about Russ and Roger. It was called Russ and Roger Go Beyond, but I think now they're just calling it Russ and Roger. And
I saw that Josh Gad has been cast as
Roger Ebert.
And
they're
still going with Will Ferrell.
Will Ferrell is Russ, which I think is perfect. Yeah. I think Will Ferrell is going to make a great Russ. And Michael Winterbottom is directing. I don't know if they've started filming yet. Maybe they have.
Yeah, he did the Trip movies, didn't he?
He did 24-Hour Party People. And,
So
That's the most exciting. And that's based on a book I read called Big Bosoms and Square Jaws, which is a great book by Jimmy McDonough, who's my favorite biographer.
Yeah, that is a great book. I enjoyed that quite a bit.
Well, you know, we lost Roger Ebert, and we also lost Richard Corliss. And the thing is that they helped expand how you looked at movies. And even if you didn't agree with them, you could appreciate their insight and their viewpoint. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's an important thing, because that shapes what we do. And so you have to love movies. People that are so negative about movies, you got to find.
I don't get that.
Oh, yeah.
I don't either. You got to find something that you like. I mean, obviously, we all have different tastes, and I can do without the teens saving the dystopian future.
Yeah, and the teen with cancer.
Now, what are some of your favorite movies so far of 2015, Lynn?
Yeah. Okay, well, I agree with you guys. Mad Max Fury Road.
Yes.
Oh, Charlize Theron. Oh, my God. When she's And, oh, Tom Hardy. To me, he is the next Marlon Brando.
So you're looking forward to that Craze movie. I'm all forward to that, too.
Where
is it,
he plays
Legend? Is that what that's called?
Yeah.
Legend? Yeah.
And go see, go to IMDb to watch the preview. It's stunning. I do love when an actor transforms himself into a person you know, like the true story, like Joseph Gordon-Levitt's going to be Snowden, and Michael Fassbender's going to play Steve Jobs.
Yeah, and Tom Hiddleston is Hank Williams. There's a lot of biographies coming out the rest of this year.
That's usually
where they mine the Oscar noms from these bios.
Sure.
A lot of times, I should say.
Yeah, I know only a handful of actors have played fictional characters that have won the Oscar the last few years, so it's been mostly you know, biographies and things of that nature. But yeah, there was a big article in the Post this weekend about how many films based on true stories are coming out in the next couple of months. It's really amazing.
Yeah.
It is. And what else did you like this year? I liked, you know, there was a lot of stuff this summer that I thought was really funny. I liked Trainwreck. I liked Spy. I liked Pitch Perfect 2.
Yeah.
I thought they were very delightful, entertaining movies.
Those were
all
funny movies, definitely.
You can't discount being entertained.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But you were talking about how some people just hate movies. I don't know if you get this a lot. You hear people saying, you know, whatever the critics hate, I know I'm going to like. And, you know, if they like something, I just like, how can you make a blanket statement like that? Yeah. Come on, you know. And they would say stuff like that. And I'd say, so you didn't like The Lion King. Well, no, I liked it. Well, the Ebert and Siskel loved it. So, I mean, so you should automatically hate it. So,
Well, you know, they were early champions of some of the indies like Fargo and Cameron Crowe's Say Anything. Roger Ebert had that on his top 10.
Mm-hmm.
There's a movie by David Gordon Green called Undertow.
Yeah.
It has Josh Lucas, and he's a villain. Josh Lucas is always better as a villain, I think.
Yeah.
And Dermot Mulroney. And Jamie Bell. And it's fascinating.
Yeah, I've seen it.
And I would really like to see David Gordon Green back because, you know, to me, those throwaway movies like Pineapple Express and, you know, he really has potential. And so I think films like that are worth finding out, you know, the ones that you have to dig for that people might not
Did you
have
see Mistress heard. America?
I did not. Oh. Noah Baumbach.
Yeah, it's really good.
Frances Ha?
One of my favorite movies of the year.
Is it Frances Ha?
It's more of a broad comedy, I would say, than Frances Ha. And it's
I did like While We're Young, Adam Driver.
Oh, yeah, that's one of my favorites, too. I'd say Baumbach's directed two of my five favorite movies so far this year with Mistress America and While We're Young.
While We're Young had a lot to say, and I think Adam Driver's up and coming. He's in the new Star Wars. Oh, Oscar Isaac.
Oh, yeah, he's
that's an upcoming.
He's in the new Star Wars as well.
Yes.
And so some of those guys are just, you know, compelling to watch.
Yeah.
You just hang on to whatever they're doing. It just, I don't know, it just transports you to a new world.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad you joined us this morning.
Thank you. Thanks
now,
for asking.
We're going to do what we always do, and that is talk about the top 10 over the weekend since we record on Monday morning and we get this up on Monday night. It's sort of timely. And usually Michelle does this. She's much better at it than I am. But I'll give it a shot. Number one was The Perfect Guy. Nobody in this room saw The Perfect Guy. The Perfect Guy starred Michael Ealy, who's done well. Sana Lathan is the female lead.
Yeah,
I'm not familiar with her.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of her in was Love and Basketball, and that was a long time ago, at least 10 years ago or so. Morris Chestnut has been in those Best Man movies.
Right. And then also the Think Like a Man movies. I think they're all alums
I know Michael Ealy was in those, too.
Yes.
It looks like a Women in Peril film. I've seen the trailer. They sure give away a lot of the plot in the trailer.
It looks like a Lifetime movie on BET or something, you know.
Yes.
It,
yeah. The ex-boyfriend is a stalker.
Well, no, the current boyfriend, I guess. She breaks up with Morris Chestnut, who's the good guy, I guess, and Michael Ealy is supposedly the perfect guy that she's seeing, the new guy, and it turns out he's dark.
But I will say,
evil.
I will say that we said the same thing about The Gift. When I saw the trailer for The Gift, I thought, well, they just gave away the whole plot of the trailer, and this looks like a pretty standard thriller, blah, blah, blah. And that would end up being a terrific movie. So who knows? Maybe I would like The Perfect Guy.
I don't know if I'll
Well, those two men are fairly hunky dudes, I will say. They're mighty fine to look at.
And the poster is Sana Lathan in the center of those two hunky dudes with an outfit that's open to her navel. I was like, come on, man. man. And we want to think this is like, you know, Basic Instinct, you know, 3 or something like that.
So that was number one with $26.7 million. The Visit, which we're going to review here at length in a couple of minutes, was number two at 25.6. So it wasn't too far behind The Perfect Guy. Number three was The War Room. And nobody in this room has seen The War Room. I don't know anyone who's seen The War Room. Do you, Lynn?
No.
I have some people on Facebook saying, oh, it's the greatest, and oh, this is the kind of movie they should be making and all that.
Well, it hasn't been well reviewed. It's one of these Christian films, and I guess these Christian films are doing really well.
Yeah, because there's another one on the list. So.
Yeah, there is. A Walk in the Woods was number four. That's pretty good, actually, to have that kind of movie that's kind of marketed towards older audiences.
And directed by Belleville's own Ken Kropos.
That's right, that's right.
Yes, yeah. Well, you mentioned about liking Redford. Did you see that one, Walk in the Woods?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah,
I did. I thought that Redford and Nolte were excellent. And, of course, it's in our wheelhouse, you know. And and it's based on a true story, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that made 4.6, which is really good that it's still in the top five. Like I
said,
Mission Impossible was number five, so it actually pulled ahead of Straight Outta Compton.
Yeah, that's
Mission Impossible did 4.1. Straight Outta Compton, which was number one for I think 3 weeks in a row, has dropped down to number six. And I still haven't seen Straight Outta Compton. Did you see Straight Outta Compton, Liam?
I have not.
Oh, yeah, Jim's seen it and really liked it a lot.
It's one of the best of the summer, I must say. Yeah, it's terrific. Don't be put off if you don't like rap music, because it's a really good story and it's compelling characters.
No Escape. We liked No Escape. I didn't love it, but it was a decent film. That was at number seven with 2.8.
Their new ad campaign did not work.
No, but at least it's still in the top 10. Transporter Refueled, which I saw and reviewed last week. It was an okay action film, made 2.7. That was number eight. Number nine is the other Christian movie that you alluded to, 90 Minutes in Heaven, with Hayden Christensen and is it Kate Bosworth?
Yeah. They're the people I recognize. And, well, you can barely recognize Hayden in it because he's got a big bushy mustache in it. And I guess he's doing an American, you know, accent or Southern accent in it or something.
Yeah, I think he gets in some kind of car wreck and dies and goes to heaven or something like that.
Is he still wooden?
We haven't seen it.
Yeah, that's the thing with these Christian movies. Yeah, these Christian movies, very rarely do they show them to us.
Almost never.
We got to see, you know, what is it, Heaven is for Real?
Yeah, Heaven is for Real. Greg Kinnear was the
little
only
boy
one
I saw.
Yeah,
show them to us. Come on, don't be chicken.
Well, I guess they figure they don't have to.
And they're
not well reviewed, so why should they show them to critics and get a bunch of reviews out there in advance? That's just going to keep audiences down.
That's like Tyler Perry films. Never are they shown for critics. Because, they're crowd-pleasing, audience-driven shows, and they don't need our support.
Yeah, well, except for that, when he tried to cross over and be an action star in Alex Cross, they showed that to us.
He was surprising in Gone Girl.
He was
excellent.
Number 10 was Un Gallo con Muchos Huevos, which is an animated Spanish language film that has not played in St. Louis.
No, I think it is playing in some theaters here in St. Louis. Okay. Yes. And I from what I understand, it is subtitled, so it's interesting to have a kids movie and they haven't dubbed it.
Interesting.
I saw the trailer and it was subtitled. I was really surprised.
Okay.
And
well, those are the top 10. Like I said, The Perfect Guy was number one at the box office this weekend, but number two was M. Night Shyamalan's. Did I pronounce that right?
Shyamalan,
yeah.
I always mispronounce that poor guy's name. Was number two, and Lynn and I both saw The Visit. I reviewed it for WeAreMovieGeeks.com. I gave it 2.5 out of 5. Lynn reviewed it for the Belleville News Democrat and gave it 3 out of 4. So, Lynn, it sounds like you liked The Visit a bit more than me. What did you like about The Visit?
I did. I thought that the grandparents, besides being crap crazy, were a fascinating characters. And the kids, I love the kids.
Well, see,
and they were precocious. I know you didn't.
I didn't like the kids. But I did like the grandparents, you're right. Especially Deanna Dunagan.
Yes.
Now, she won the Tony for August Osage County.
Yes. She's a Chicago actress, the Steppenwolf Theater. Very prestigious. In fact, little aside, I went to college with the founders of Steppenwolf.
Oh, yeah.
John Malkovich, Laurie Metcalf, Terry Kinney, Jeff Perry, and so forth. Anyway, she is revered on stage as a stage actress in Chicago. So she was good.
She was good. I even said in my review, she is like the horror character of the year. She's the Freddy Krueger of 2015. And, you know, there is something sort of creepy and scary about grandparents when you're a kid. Right now, my 84-year-old mother-in-law who has Alzheimer's has moved in with us. So I could sort of relate to some of the things in this film. My kids are kind of afraid of her a little bit. They go up to their room where they used to hang out. And downstairs, but now they kind of go to the room. The cats are afraid of my feeble Alzheimer's-ridden mother-in-law, bless her heart. But there is something kind of creepy and kind of scary about old people, don't you think? Shyamalan did a good job of tapping into that.
I do think so. I grew up with my grandparents, so I have great affection for older people and what they can bring to your life. But they were of a different time. You know, my grandparents grew up during the Depression. My grandfather helped Houdini with the trick and saw Babe Ruth hit a home run. But that's another story. But anyway, they were very stalwart, went through World War II kind of people. And they did not take to frivolity very well. And if you were rambunctious or horse around, you know, you get yelled at. But these grandparents start off being warm and loving and cozy, and then something's not quite right. Yeah. And I thought Shyamalan built suspense really well, and I was creeped out. I did not see the twist coming. But one of our friends, Sandy Olmsted, she sat next to me. She goes, "Do you know what it is?" And I go, "No." And she figured it out right away.
But the twist isn't a game changer. It doesn't a good twist like The Sixth Sense affects everything that happened before. And I would say it really wasn't like this with The Visit. Even if you went and watched it a second time, it's really not going to change it that much. Where The Sixth Sense, you watch it a second time, you're going to be looking for clues. Because really nobody knew these grandparents. The mother, played by Catherine Hahn, she didn't know her parents. She had been estranged with them for many years. The kids had never met the grandparents. So the fact that the twist, I don't want to give it away, happens isn't really that big a deal, I didn't think.
Well, you'll never play Yahtzee without referencing the film ever again. And there is one of the grossest things I've ever seen on screen.
It was.
And probably Plink Flamingos.
You got a picture of M. Night Shyamalan, you know, sitting in his typewriter coming up with that element.
I was surprised. I read your review. They were kind of hiding it in some of the trailers that it's another found footage film, which has become a tired stereotype in new horror films. Yeah. So I you were saying that perhaps he thought that he could put some new life into it. And you said that he cheats a little bit in it.
Well, I wouldn't know if cheating is quite the word he was used, but I said in my review, the cinematography by Maurice Alberti is slick and filmic, perfectly lit with golden hues one would expect from the rustic farm setting, which sort of negates the premise that the whole thing is shot by a 15-year-old on her camcorder.
But she's a pretty smart girl. She is just the use of her vocabulary.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I thought the characters.
But it wasn't her
really
vocabulary. It was the 50-year-old screenwriter's vocabulary. And that's what I have a problem with a lot of children in movies is they don't talk like children talk. And then when that little boy looked at the camera and did those rap songs, I know a lot of the audience was laughing at that, but I was just cringing. And he did it, I think, three times.
Yes. They're both Australian actors, the two young kids, and the boy was in Alexander and the Terrible No Good Day.
She was okay. There was one scene I think where she was sort of delivering this speech to the camera, and the camera was kind of slowly zooming in on her, and it was really a nice scene, but it didn't really fit within the rest of the film, I didn't think.
I thought Catherine Hahn did a great job as the mother because she was away and she could not help them. But to me, the best horror movies are when it's in a believable setting. It's not, you know, the stupid girls in the woods, you know, running around. It's a believable setting, and there's that sense of helplessness. Mm-hmm. There's that sense of dread. That's why I even like the Blair Witch Project.
Oh, yeah,
because,
I love the Blair Witch Project.
Because you get that being tired and hungry and exhausted and weary and lost in the woods. And so to me, all of a sudden, the little kids, when they start thinking something's not quite right here, and they're in the middle of nowhere in a farm place without any parent near. And so I like those kind of things where they're off kilter.
Yeah, but I just didn't find it particularly scary. But it takes a lot to scare me because I see a lot of horror films. And I didn't think it was particularly funny either. Like I said, I couldn't stand a kid in his rap songs. The gross scene. Let's get back to that. I don't want to give it away too much, but it does involve soiled adult diapers. Who thinks these things up?
Well, somebody
asked effective. It was effective. I will say that.
Yeah, somebody asked me because of the trailer on TV if it was like Hansel and Gretel.
Yeah,
because of that oven scene that they're showing. And I said, no, not at all.
Yeah, the oven scene doesn't go where you expect it to. And that oven scene actually happens twice.
That was the scene my mother asked me about. She saw a commercial for it. She says, what's that movie with the where she's making the kids get in the oven? I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. So it must be The Visit. Okay. Yeah, I never saw that in the trailer. So.
But I do think M. Night Shyamalan is back because he's had a string of, he's, obviously The Sixth Sense, everybody, and you know what was great about that is because that was pre-social media and not a single person gave that twist away.
No.
Well, when you went to it, you were fresh.
Well, the Post-Dispatch kind of gave it away. You remember that article they did about it? There was a layout problem because when you turn the page, at the top of the page where you'd see the page number, it said in a headline, the top six clues that Bruce Willis is already dead.
Who wrote that article? Joe Pollack maybe back.
If it wasn't at the top of the page, it would have been a little bit better. But your eye is drawn right to it.
Oh my goodness, that's like the Happy Days where Ralph Malph says Anthony Perkins is his own mother.
and then he says, we'll go see Mr. Roberts instead. And he said, I cried when he died.
My goodness. And then, of course, the famous Simpsons where Homer's in line and he goes, Darth Vader is Luke's father.
There was a big snafu with that. Was Marvel put out the comic book adaptation of Empire about a month before the movie came out, so I just nonchalantly flipped through it and I went right to that page. Son of a gun.
But The Visit, you're right. The Visit will be good for Shyamalan's career. He self-financed it. It only cost $5 million to make, and it made five times its budget on its opening weekend. I said in my review, The Visit is Shyamalan's best movie in years. That's not saying much, but it might be all the beleaguered director needs right now.
It's going to keep him away from the Razzies this year, so that's good.
Very good.
Yeah. Well, I thought Unbreakable was truly ahead of its time and very underrated, and if you watch it nowadays,
it's on Netflix.
It's such a good movie.
That was 2001, I think.
Like Signs in the Village, but then I
like The Happening just because it's so bad, it becomes sort of fun. I watched The Happening probably the most of any Shyamalan movie.
I missed that, but The Lady in the Water,
Last time I left a theater in the middle of a movie.
Yeah,
I couldn't take it anymore.
But Michelle, who's usually here, is a big fan of M. Night Shyamalan and is always quick to defend him.
Well, it's good to see somebody there's a good redemption story there. Like, he's trying, he's back.
All right, the other movie that opens Friday, well, actually a bunch of movies open Friday, but the other movie that opens this Friday that I have seen is called Captive. Captive stars David O. Yellow O. and Kate Mara, who is the sister of Rumi Mara. Rooney Mara?
Yes. She was last seen as the Invisible Woman, or maybe last not seen.
The Captive is a true story of Ashley Smith and Brian Nichols. Brian Nichols was on trial in Atlanta in 2007 for rape. He was kind of a career criminal, not a good guy. He managed to overpower a guard, took this guard's gun, walked into a courtroom, shot a judge dead, shot a court reporter dead, shot another guard dead, escaped from the building, shot someone else dead later the day, and ended up at Ashley Smith's apartment, where they sat around for 7 hours and sort of bonded. She had just been given this book called The Purpose-Driven Life, which is a Christian book. She read this book to him. She just happened to have some meth laying around, and she gave him some meth to smoke, and eventually, I don't want to give it away.
That's a true story.
It is a true story. She became a public speaker and wrote this book called Unlikely Angel, which the movie is based on, and was on the set of the film a lot. She's now got this movie deal. So this movie Captive opens this weekend. Lynn and I both interviewed the star David Oyelowo last week in a roundtable interview, which was nice, and he was a nice guy, and he had a lot of interesting things to say. Unfortunately, The Captive is not a very good movie. It's not a very good movie at all. It's very bland. It's not particularly well written, and I hate to say it, but it's not particularly well acted, especially by David Oyelowo. I thought he sort of handled his character all wrong. He he shoots, you know, four people, and then he shows up, and he's awfully calm for sort of a mad dog killer. When she gives him the meth, he starts bouncing off the walls a little bit, but I think he would have been doing that right from the beginning. And the movie is just not particularly well made. It's got this sort of synthetic score like you might hear on an episode of Law & Order or something. It just seems kind of cheap.
Does it seem like a cable movie?
It does. It totally seems like a cable movie. In fact, when
like basic cable?
Or maybe Redbox. But when I walked out of it, I even said to somebody, I said, I can't believe this movie's even playing theatrically. There is a big Christian angle to it because this book that she read to him, which supposedly inspired him to do what he does. And I'm wondering if Oyelowo, who's a producer, would have teamed up with one of these Christian producers that made, you know, The War Room or 90 Minutes in Heaven and really played up the Christian angle. Maybe the movie might have been a little different, might do better at the box office. I don't see it making much of an impression at the box office. Like I say, though, it's directed by Jerry Jameson, and we looked him up on IMDb. Apparently he's 82 years old and directed episodes of Gomer Pyle and Andy Griffith and That Girl and all this stuff. So I was a little confused. I was kind of scratching my head. I thought maybe that was a mistake, but I guess it's not. The last movie he directed was 11 years ago, and I can't remember what it was called, but it was also a Christian movie. So I guess maybe that's why they hired him to direct this thing. I don't know.
Well, you know, considering we've got two Christian-themed films in the top ten, I think it could do well if they really start playing it up to the church groups and things like that.
So far, they're not, though. If you look at the posters, it's him running with a gun. I think they're trying to make it look like some sort of action film or something.
The trailer, I think, is a little misleading, but she did lose her child because she is a meth addict.
She got
her back. But it's about redemption of two people, and he is in solitary confinement now.
Yeah.
But David Yellow, what was fascinating to me to interview him was he is so passionate about this film. He really went all in, and he is a stage-trained actor. And, of course, his Martin Luther King performance last year, I thought, should have been nominated for an Oscar. And he was so impressed.
It was too strong of a year.
For other
actors.
You're right.
I don't think he was robbed of anything, and there was some controversy when he didn't get nominated, which I thought was absolutely ridiculous.
Well, you think who would
Ray
be...
Ray Fiennes didn't get nominated either, and he deserved it far more than
You're right.
David
You're
Oyelowo.
Right. Well, if you look at the five that were nominated, you can't argue with any of them.
Yeah.
And it was just a strong
Wait a minute. Steve Carell should not have been nominated Foxcatcher.
So, Ray Fiennes over him.
Sure.
Yes. Oh, my God. Ray Fiennes was so funny in the Grand Budapest Hotel.
But David Oyelowo was an outspoken Christian, which you don't hear that from a lot of actors.
You're right.
And I even asked him in an interview, do you think that affects you getting roles? And he basically said, I don't care.
Yeah, well, he is going back to the stage. He told me next year he'll be on Broadway. But, he's from London, and he was the first African actor to play Henry VI on the
impressive
London stage. So he is very impressive, and I think he is one to continue to watch. But, this was a passion project for him.
And a miss, I think. And so I don't recommend Captive, but you can see my interview with David Oyelowo or read it on WeAreMovieGeeks.com. And you're going to be publishing your interview also with David Oyelowo over in the Belleville News Democrat this week.
Online, BND.com.
All right. So I don't really recommend Captive. But I do wish the best for Mr. Oyelowo. I do recommend Mad Max Fury Road.
we all do.
It's Jim and my favorite movie of the year so far.
Sure.
And, I saw it four times when it played at the theater, which I can't remember the last movie I saw four times. Then the last week was my birthday. My kids gave me the Mad Max Fury Road Blu-ray, and I sort of, was sort of a little forlorn. I thought, gosh, I can't wait to watch this Blu-ray, but I'm a little sad that I'm not going to be able to see Mad Max on the big screen in 3D one more time. Well, imagine my surprise when I looked in the paper and looked at the movie time. Sure enough, they reissued Mad Max Fury Road, and it's currently on the IMAX and the 3D.
Yes.
I'm sure just for a week, because I think Everest is probably going to knock it out of the IMAX screen on Friday. Mm. So Saturday night, I took kids for a fifth time, Well, the first time for them. Time at the Galaxy. It played on the mega screen in 3D, and it was absolutely spectacular. Every time I see that movie, it's so dense, I just pick up more and more.
Oh, it's so fascinating because it's such an adrenaline rush. And when you see it and you realize that George Miller is 70 years old and directed it.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of movie, that's what I love, like Ryan Gosling in Drive. Scorsese's The Departed. You're sitting there and it starts and you're like, you sit up and you're like, this is a movie. Mad Max Fury Road has so many great facets to it, but let's not forget Charlize Theron.
Oh, yeah. She's great.
Oh, no one's forgetting her.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
She's really the star of the movie. And every time I see it, I realize that she actually has a much bigger part than Tom Hardy. And I mean, it's a movie, 70% of the movie is vehicles barreling down desert wastelands. But it has so much depth and so much emotion and so much art that it's remarkable. It's
and
transcendent.
Imagination.
Yeah. I mean, I really do think it's going to get a lot of Oscar noms. We always talk about movies in terms of Oscar noms here at We Are Movie Geeks, the podcast. But I really think technical awards, possibly Miss Theron will be nominated, probably in the supporting category, because I don't think she'd get nominated in the lead. But the score by Junkie XL is amazing. The cinematography, the art direction, the editing, the direction by George Miller.
Wasn't it very little CGI?
Well, originally I think they said they weren't going to do any CGI, but then they sort of bent. And sure, the sandstorm has some CGI, but the stunt work for the most part is not CGI. I think all the greatest stuntmen in the world wanted to work on this film. They all gathered in South Africa where it was shot.
Now, they were all probably inspired by Road Warrior.
Yeah, they probably grew up as big fans of the Road Warrior, exactly, and they just to star in this update. And I can't remember the last movie I saw five times at the theater. May have been the Road Warrior.
Wasn't the villain in the original?
Well, that was the original Mad Max of 79. Hugh Kearns. Oh, I'm not going to remember his name.
Oh, he's terrifying. To me, a movie is as good as the villain.
Yeah.
And he is terrifying. I saw it again on the drive-in screen at the Skyview Drive-In at Memorial Day. My kids were home, and so we went to the Skyview and saw that and Pitch Perfect 2. Oh. And it was delightful to sit outside and watch it.
Okay, so we do recommend Mad Max Fury Road. You'll have a chance to see it probably just this week. So get out there and see it again if you haven't seen it. I don't know what's wrong with you. There's a bunch of movies opening Friday.
Oh, my gosh.
There'll be The Maze Runner 2, which there'll be a review by Kate Marquis at We Are Movie Geeks.
It's a feast next weekend.
There is. Of course, Captive opens Friday, and a bunch of others, including Black Mass, which we're seeing tonight, which stars Johnny Depp. It's the true story of Whitey Bulger.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Oh, me too.
What do we know about that movie? It's gotten pretty good reviews.
It's from the director of Crazy Heart and
Scott
Out of the
Cooper
Furnace.
Is his
Scott
name,
Cooper,
yeah.
The actor turned writer, director. Yeah. And it's based on a true story, and it looks like Johnny Depp might be kind of getting away from the quirky stuff and doing some hard acting again. I was talking about it with my brother, and I said, this might be maybe closer to Donnie Brasco, which would be a wonderful thing.
Oh, he and Pacino and Donnie Brasco were amazing. Acting is all in the eyes, and Depp has got such a wealth of talent that he hasn't been using in the last couple of movies because they've been so strange.
Coasting on his quirk and his charm too much lately. So it's good to see he's getting back to some tougher stuff.
So you'll be reviewing Black Mass for WeirdMovieGeeks.com, Jim. Also, tomorrow night we're seeing Everest.
Oh, yes.
Everest stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Josh Brolin and John
Hawks.
Yeah, Keira Knightley.
Emma
in
Watson
there.
Is in it, I believe. Yes.
Yes, it's a huge cast.
Yeah, it looks really good. It's directed by Baltasar Kormákur.
It looks terrifying.
Yeah, it does. It's in 3D, and it's in the IMAX.
It'll jumpstart my fear of heights again.
And
we talked about Pawn Sacrifice last week. And
that opens Friday. I'll be reviewing that at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. Look for my review Thursday night. And we talked about it at length last Friday, but it's really, really good. It's one of the better movies of the summer.
Well, getting back to Black Mass, this guy was the most terrifying mob in South Boston. And then he turns.
Yeah.
State's evidence.
Well,
or
Jack
FBI.
Nicholson's character in The Departed is based on Whitey Bulger. Frank Costello, I think, was his name in that film.
Mm-hmm.
And they go into the whole FBI informant issue in that film as well.
Yeah, I guess Joel Edgerton is the FBI guy
who was a childhood friend of Whitey Bulger. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, and Joel wrote the Gift. Wrote and directed The Gift.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes, he has a lot of layers. That
he has a lot of talent, Mr. Edgerton.
Yes.
A lot of edge.
Yes. Yes. Some say he was the best one in The Great Gatsby, but I'm one of the minority. I love that movie.
I do, too. I love that movie. Great. That was one of my top five of the year a couple of years ago. God, I watched that all the time.
Yeah. That was in my top ten.
I have nothing to say about The Great Gatsby.
That's because Jim didn't see it, I guess.
I saw it. I suffered through it. Okay. How dare you, sir?
Do you think Leonardo DiCaprio is ever going to win an Oscar?
Yeah, I do. Maybe he'll win this year for The Revenant.
I have a friend of mine that says if he did win for Gilbert Grape, he's never going to win, but I think he's going to get one eventually.
Did he say that 20 years ago?
Yeah. He said he was so perfect in Gilbert Grape, that if he didn't get it for that, he's never going to get it for anything, but I dispute that.
One friend of mine thought that he was really mentally challenged. How did they get this mentally challenged person to play this part?
He's good in it. It's worth checking out if you can find it on Netflix or one of the streaming services.
And Johnny Depp is quite good in it, too.
Another movie that opens Friday is, well, it doesn't actually open Friday, but it's playing this weekend Friday. It's The Turbo Kid. Have you guys heard of that one?
No.
I saw the trailer. Looks fun.
Yeah, it's based on a 5-minute long little short that's been playing that got millions of hits on YouTube, and it was by a Canadian named Francois Simard. And the short's called T is for Turbo. You can go to YouTube and type in T is for Turbo. And basically it's about this kid who's on his BMX bike, and he's battling these bad guys in this wasteland desert. But it's really bloody, but it's got sort of imaginative, sort of Troma Studio-style gory effects in it. And apparently he made enough money to make a feature. He got Michael Ironside to play the villain in the feature. And, it looks like... I think he's sort of directed it to look like one of the Road Warrior ripoffs that came out in the mid-'80s.
Oh, yes.
He's kind of going for that vibe. People seem to like it. I think it looks kind of silly, but...
It looks like it could be fun.
It could be fun.
It'd be interesting to see if it can outlast the 5 minutes there, because a lot of films, especially the films based on Saturday Night Live sketches, they work as like 5-minute sketches, but hour and a half features sometimes the joke is spread too thin, stretched too far.
But that's Midnight This Friday and Saturday Night at the High Point as part of the Late Night Grindhouse monthly Midnight series, which is hosted by our friend Angie Treifenbeck. Usually they do it the first weekend of the month, but the High Point has been under renovation. They finally opened up this past weekend, and I guess they have new seats.
Really? In the main auditorium?
I think so,
huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Another great reason to go to a great theater, because it's a great theater.
Yeah. And then this Saturday morning, they're showing Gaslight.
Oh my goodness.
Well, the stage version of that is going to be at the Repertory Theater.
That's why they're doing it.
Uh-huh. Well, the back lot is really a great place.
It is. It only seats 44 plus a couch.
But what a neat space.
Yeah, it is really nice.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of films there.
Enjoy a beverage there, too.
Yes.
And they do have a lovely selection of concessions, I will say.
Well, another movie that opens this week, it doesn't open this week. It's playing once this week, and this is a documentary that I've really been looking forward to seeing since I first read about it. Michael Haffner saw it at Fantastic Fest a year ago, so it's been sitting around waiting for us to see. It's called Electric Boogaloo, The Wild Untold Story of Canon Films. It is showing this Thursday night only, which will be September 17th at 7 o'clock at the Tivoli.
It's hoping it's on the main screen there.
I'm pretty sure it is. I'll double check.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely worthy of it. Now, did you say that, were you telling me last night, Tom, that this is directed by the same fellow that did this excellent documentary a few years back about the Australian film scene?
Yeah, his name is Mark Hartley. The movie you're referring to is called Not Quite Hollywood.
Oh, that was good.
That was really good. But it wasn't just about the Australian film scene. It was about the low-budget exploitation movies, horror and sex and action films that were made in Australia in the 70s and 80s.
Like really Patrick and Road Games and things like that. Yeah,
exactly. And Turkey Shoot. A lot of sex movies that were made. He also made another one called Machete Maidens Unleashed, which was all about the films that were shot in the Philippines in the 60s and 70s. Roger Corman would use the Philippines and send Pam Grier and Sed Haig down there to make all these great women's prison films. So he made a documentary about that, and it covered Coppola shooting a lot of Apocalypse Now in the Philippines as well. It's another great documentary. It didn't play theatrically here.
Yeah, we'll have to find it online.
Yeah, but I'm really looking forward to Electric Boogaloo, The Wild Untold Story of Canon Films. Canon Films was a studio that was doing pretty well, and then around the early 80s, it was bought by a pair of Israel cousins named Yoram Globus and Menachem Golan.
Yeah. Now, as I understand, Menachem was actually a director. He directed The Apple, didn't he?
The Apple. Have you ever seen The Apple?
I've heard about The Apple.
Yeah, have you ever seen The Apple?
It's strange.
I just watched the trailer. It sort of looks like a cross between Rocky Horror Picture Show and Can't Stop the Music. It's like a disco musical that takes place in the future, and they're worshiping this apple. And it stars Mary Catherine Stewart, who was in Night of the Comet.
Yes.
And it looks like a blast. I think you can get it on DVD. I think it was unavailable for a long time, but now it's out there.
Kind of a cult film.
Yeah, a very small cult, apparently, because I was sort of unfamiliar with it until fairly recently. But yeah, these guys, the Golden Globus, they called it, days of Canon Studios. They made a lot of cheapo action films, musicals, sex films.
Yeah, they were quick to leap upon any sort of craze, as I recall. Yeah, I mean, they had the first sort of rapping films and the first breakdancing films.
Yeah, Breakin' and Breakin' 2, Electric Boogaloo, which is where this documentary gets its title from.
Even the Lambada, they did a movie about. The Forbidden Dance.
Lambada, the Forbidden Dance. And then there was a second Lambada movie, I think it was called Lambada Set the Night on Fire. But I think the Forbidden Dance. The thing Set the Night on Fire had Gregory Peck's son in it.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, this was around the same time, I guess, that New World was sort of its last legs, and New Line was still going strong.
Yeah.
And there's always been a tradition of these sort of maybe second-string movie studios there, but sometimes they would come out with stuff that was a lot more entertaining and had more passion than the major studios.
I love these films. I actually printed out a list of all the Canon films from the 80s, and so many of these I saw at the theater. Charles Bronson, who everybody knows is my favorite actor of all time, he was a Canon regular there, and starting with Death Wish 2 in 1982, he made five or six movies for Canon, including Death Wish 3 and The Messenger of Death and Kinjite Forbidden Subjects and Murphy's Law, which is a fantastic film. And then, of course, the other Chuck was Chuck Norris. Chuck Norris did Missing in Action for Canon, which is a huge hit. They made a couple of sequels to that. Invasion USA, Hero in the Terror. These are all, I saw all of these at the theater. I really never made the connection. Oh, these are all from the same studio, because there was a lot of studios. You mentioned New World, and there was Crown, and there was a lot of low budget studios that you would see movies at the theater back in the 80s.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that I read that they were kind of the go-go boys, as they were called, the heads of Canon, really knew how to sell a movie. And a lot of times what they were selling didn't quite deliver on what the poster or what the commercial promise, but I don't know. I guess they filled the grindhouses before they got shut down, and a lot of drive-ins that.
Yeah, I saw a lot of these at the drive-in, but I saw a lot of them at the theaters too. There
at
was
the multiplex.
Well, even there was the Sunset Hills Cinema by my house, which is where the movie where I saw a lot of these things. Like I mentioned, the Chuck Norris. Then they had their own. Then they came up with their own action. You know, Norris and Bronson, of course, were already established action heroes before they started working for Canon. But they came up with their own action hero. His name was Michael Dudikoff.
See the American Ninja.
Yeah, American Ninja.
Oh, yeah.
See, they were ripping off the martial arts, the
Avenging
Bruce Lee
Force
stuff.
Yeah, Michael Dudikoff. I don't know whatever happened to him. He often he always had this. There was a black actor named Steve James that was sort of his sidekick. you'd probably recognize Steve James. He was in Altman's The Player. He actually died at age 42.
Wasn't a lot of these after the Rambo craze? After
well, Mystic in Action was definitely a Rambo knockoff that
I understand
business.
That they either Golan or Globus actually credited James Cameron for Missing in Action too, that they had somehow gotten a copy of the screenplay for Rambo, and so they kind of took elements of that. Mm-hmm. And he acknowledged that, so it's surprising.
But then they put their foot in the water with some art films. They came out with stuff like Fool for Love, which I believe was directed by Robert Altman, wasn't?
Sam Shepard.
Runaway Train was actually up for an Oscar for Jim.
Yeah, Runaway Train's an interesting film. I love Runaway Train. That was actually based on a treatment by Kurosawa. Kurosawa was going to make that with Toshiro Mifune. That was supposed to be his first color film, and it fell through, and it sat on a shelf for a decade or two, and it was sold to the Canon people as a project for Bronson. Bronson was supposed to play the John Voight role. They decided to put more money into it and put an Oscar winner in the lead role, and it was a big hit for Canon, and it was nominated for 3 Academy Awards, including John Voight for actor, and Eric Roberts in his only Oscar-nominated performance.
Yeah.
It's a great movie.
And I just saw up here Grace Quigley, one of the last films of Katharine Hepburn and her co-star, and that is Nick Nolte. So.
Oh, yeah.
yeah, that's kind of interesting.
52 Pickup, you ever seen
oh,
that?
Oh, yeah, with, yeah, John Roy Frankenhammer, Scheider. Right?
Yeah.
And the Hanoi Hilton?
Yeah,
wasn't Michael that Michael? Moriarty. Yeah, yeah. Was, I was just going to say, wasn't that Michael Moriarty?
Yeah. Oh, and I'd forgotten that actually they got Stallone for a couple of
yeah,
films.
Yeah, over the top, this, the arm
and
wrestling
was
classic.
Cobra there? Also?
Oh, yeah, yeah, Cobra.
Cobra, yes, yeah. Yes. And there's an interesting sort of superhero connection to the Cannon Brothers, because I recall picking up Variety when I was in college, and they would have these lavish ads, like yeah. 7 or 8 pages, and every year they were promoting that the Spider-Man film was coming.
Yeah. Half of the movies never really came out.
No, no, that they were going to do Spider-Man for a while. Tobey Hooper was going to do it for a while. Albert Pyun, and they wrote a screenplay, even made some sets, but nothing ever really became of it. And I think that's maybe the reason that it took so long for them to work out the screen rights for Spider-Man, because I have a feeling that the Cannon guys were just selling the distribution rights to different countries everywhere that they could.
But they did make a infamous superhero movie. We were talking about this one a little last night. Superman 4, Quest for Peace.
Oh, yes, yes.
Which really killed, not only killed that series, but it really killed any Superman movie for a couple of decades until the Brandon Routh thing came out.
I have a little more affection for that than Superman 3, the Richard Pryor Superman film. But I've read a couple of Superman history books over the last few weeks, and they talk about that, about how the Salkins wanted to generate some money. They'd gotten a deal with Warners, but they didn't want to sink the money into it, so they got a hold of Cannon, and Cannon severely slashed the budget on it. It went from $36 million to $17 million. Yeah. That seemed a lot these days, but they got Hackman back and they had to make quite a few deals to get Christopher Reeve
Margot Kidder back
for a cameo basically for it. Marielle Hemingway is more the female lead in it, but they Christopher Reeve had been wanting to do this movie that Cannon did produce called Street Smart, which I think might have gotten a nomination for Morgan Freeman.
Wasn't that his first Oscar nom.
His first film was a movie called Blade.
Okay.
But that was his first Oscar nom.
So I think Christopher had this idea, or someone had submitted it to him, about Superman getting rid of nuclear weapons, and that was he was wanting to push this message in it. So he also was the second unit director on Superman 4, The Quest for Peace.
But we can't talk about Superman 4 without talking about Mark Pillow as Nuclear Man.
Oh, the classic.
He's got this 80s hair, and he really kind of looks like He-Man, and don't they battle on another planet or something?
Now, of course, Cannon did do the He-Man movie, Masters of the Universe film.
And I think it was those two films that both of those films lost a lot of money for Cannon.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that was sort of the beginning of the end for Cannon Studios.
Yeah, they were actually going to do Masters of the Universe 2, and Mattel wouldn't get them the rights, so they just turned it into Cyborg with Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Wasn't the Masters of the Universe the live-action not the animated
one. Right, it was live action.
Yeah, with Dolph Lundgren. And Courtney Cox is in it,
Chelsea.
Frank Langella, I believe.
Skeletor, yes.
Yeah, and what is Chelsea's last name? Because she married Scott Bakula.
I know who you're talking about.
You know Scott Bakula's parents live two doors down from me?
Oh, wow.
No, but his father just died.
But what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, yeah. And, they also were touting that they were going to do a Captain America film.
Yeah.
And turns out that once Golden Globus split, I think Yoram Globus started 21st Century Communications or Entertainment, he did produce a Captain America film in 1990 that never played theaters here in this country, went right to home video with Matt Salinger, J.D.'s son, as Captain America. And actually, it popped up on Channel 24 a couple of weeks ago, and it's terrible. And I guess they had some German investors, so they made the Red Skull Italian.
Well, what's not terrible is Electric Boogaloo, the wild untold story of Cannon Films. At least I've heard it's not terrible. I haven't seen it. I cannot wait. I'm not even a big documentary guy, but I cannot wait to see this. This is this Thursday night at 7 o'clock at the Tivoli, one showing only. We're going to have to wrap it up here in a second, though. One other quick plug. Listen to Jim and myself and Michelle McHugh this Sunday night, which will be the 20th, on KMOX AM 1120 from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. We'll be talking about movies. Lynn Venhaus, thank you so much for joining us here at We Are Movie Geeks.
Thank you. I wanted to tell you, Michelle and I are in the Alliance of Women Film Journalists, and we're coming up with the most memorable female characters list, and that'll be out soon, and Michelle and I both participated.
Oh, well, cool.
Yes.
I hope Pam Grier is mentioned in there somewhere. All right. So we've got to sign off. Listen to us again next week. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
Lynn Venhouse.
Listen to us at We Are Movie Geeks, the podcast, every week.
Black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, ta, ta, ta. Black leather, black leather.
Oh, howdy, Dave. Hello, darling.
Black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, ta, ta, ta. Black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling, black leather rock.